even though we're living in such different political climates and like just different cultural times, I think there's so many things that we can look back on and take inspiration from on how to organize now and how to like find our community and surround ourselves with our supportive community now. I want to be living proof to younger trans people that like you can be trans and love being trans and be proud of it and have joy in your life and find community that also like centers that joy.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Two young men in Indonesia to be flogged for gay sex. A UK appeals court nixes a non-binary gender marker. And building a joyful transmasculine community. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm Ava Davis.
And I'm Joe Bainline.
With News Wrap. A summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 1st, 2025. Two young men in the Indonesian province of Aceh are to be publicly beaten with a cane for having gay sex. They were arrested on November 7th after anti-queer vigilantes broke into their rented room and discovered them naked and hugging each other. Under Islamic law, they were tried for morality offenses. The 18 and 24-year-old college students were sentenced to 80 and 85 lashes, respectively. Sakwana is the single name of the judge overseeing the trial. That's a custom for many Indonesians. Her ruling found, during the trial, it was proven that the defendants committed illicit acts, including kissing and having sex. While the maximum penalty is 100 lashings in public and up to 8 years in prison, Sakwana lessened the sentences because neither had a police record, both were polite in court, and they are otherwise considered to be outstanding students. The older of the two will be flogged the most. The pair accepted their sentences without appeal. Sharia has been the law in Aceh province since a 2006 dispute with federal authorities allowed it to adopt Islamic legal practice. The rest of Indonesia is governed by secular laws. More than 100 people each year in the province have been publicly caned for various morality offenses. The scheduled public caning in Aceh comes on the heels of last week's raid on what authorities called a gay sex party in Jakarta. 56 men were arrested in a private hotel room and charged with violating the country's secular laws against obscenity and pornography.
British law does not recognize non-binary as a gender, according to the United Kingdom Court of Appeal. Cybersecurity expert Ryan Castellucci moved from Los Angeles in 2019. They obtained legal recognition as non-binary in California in 2021 and were issued a U.S. passport listing their gender as X the following year. They tried to have their gender recorded as non-binary on a U.K. gender recognition certificate, a document which changes someone's legal sex. They lost the bid in an earlier high court challenge. Meanwhile, a Trump administration executive order has eliminated the X-gender passport option. Lord Justice Singh deferred to Parliament in dismissing the appeal, saying that the UK's two-gender policy was up to lawmakers to address, not the judiciary. Castellucci called their efforts to be legally recognized as non-binary an ordeal, but their lawyers say they are considering a further appeal. At 30-something, they're looking ahead saying, "I plan to live the rest of my life here and eventually die here. Being denied the dignity of knowing my death certificate will be correct makes my stomach turn."
Iowa's transgender people are no longer protected from discrimination. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds has signed a bill that revokes the addition of gender identity to the Iowa Civil Rights Act in 2007. Thus, the current Republican-dominated state legislature has undone the statute by the previous Democratic administration and affirmed by the state Supreme Court in 2022. Hundreds of people rallied at the state Capitol building to protest the bill's imminent passage.
We are trans like we. meaning for our lives.
Iowa's legislature ignored the voices of the people. The Republicans argued that revoking gender identity protections in civil rights laws will make it easier for the state to defend its other anti-trans laws, such as the ban on trans student competitors in female sports. That's already being challenged in court. Iowa is now the first state in U.S. history to excise a class originally granted civil rights protection. Max Mowitz of queer advocacy group One Iowa told the Des Moines Register, "This law will cause real harm, making daily life harder and more uncertain for countless Iowans who simply want to live openly and authentically. History will not look kindly on this moment."
Two executive orders by U.S. President Donald Trump that threaten the civil rights of LGBTQ people and other U.S. citizens are already being roadblocked in court. Maryland-based U.S. District Judge Adam B. Abelson said that the key provisions targeting federal agencies and federal-funded diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in higher education and the private sector were impermissibly vague and threatened to chill constitutionally protected speech and activity. Abelson issued a preliminary injunction this week blocking their enforcement. The ruling noted that the administration's effort to uproot DEI programs failed to define key terms, such as equity-related and illegal DEI. Abelson was not convinced that the order was necessary to root out illegal discrimination. This challenge is being led by national education groups and the city of Baltimore. At least one other lawsuit against the anti-diversity order has been filed by Lambda Legal and the Legal Defense Fund on behalf of the National Urban League, the National Fair Housing Alliance, and AIDS Foundation Chicago.
The block on a second Trump order is keeping transgender women in U.S. women's prisons from being transferred to men's prisons. That action was to comply with the Trump decree that U.S. law recognizes only two genders, male and female. Washington, D.C.-based U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth ruled that the move would violate trans women's constitutional rights and put them in jeopardy of serious harm. Lamberth had previously issued an order to protect three trans women inmates from imminent transfer. The latest ruling expands that protection to nine additional plaintiffs who were rounded up by Bureau of Prison officials and told they would be immediately transferred to men's prisons, according to court filings. The Trump order also terminates current gender-affirming health care for trans inmates. The judge believes the lawsuit challenging the Trump anti-trans order is likely to be overturned on Eighth Amendment protections against imposing excessive bail, excessive fines, or cruel and unusual punishments. Judge Lamberth questioned the Trump administration's motives. He wrote that the order would exacerbate the symptoms of their gender dysphoria, even if they are not subject to physical or sexual violence in their new facility, whether because they will be subject to searches by male correctional officers, made to shower in the company of men, referred to as men.
The U.S. Supreme Court is letting Tennessee's virtual ban on drag performances stand. On February 24th, it decided not to hear a case challenging the law. The legislation was enacted by the Republican-controlled state in 2023. It was ruled unconstitutionally vague and substantially overbroad by a judge on the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Tennessee. However, last July, the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the decision on a technicality. The top court has now let stand its finding that the complainant, Friends of George Incorporated Drag Theater Company of Memphis, lacked the legal standing to sue. Another lawsuit challenging Tennessee's drag ban is still working its way through the U.S. judicial system. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit on behalf of Blount County Pride organizers because the law threatened prosecution of any violators during its 2023 Pride Festival.
Finally, however, there was one hearing the U.S. High Court did hold this week. The reverse discrimination case of a straight, white, cisgender woman who claims that she was denied a promotion and demoted after allegedly less qualified queer colleagues gained positions ahead of her. 60-year-old Marlene Ames worked for years for the Ohio Department of Youth Services, the state's juvenile justice system. A lower appeals court ruled in her case that a so-called majority group plaintiff must meet a higher evidentiary standard than plaintiffs in other bias cases. In other words, it's harder for heterosexual workers to prove discrimination based on sexual orientation or for white employees claiming racial bias. The Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling before the current term ends in late June. A number of civil rights groups are deeply concerned that a win for Ames could open a Pandora's box of countless reverse discrimination cases, and that could be especially dangerous in the current climate against diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending March 1st, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian Shazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Joe Bainline. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Unto me, yeah, unto me is bound, man, why can't you see?
Why can't you see?
Unto me, yeah, unto me is back in me, who you are.
He is me.
He is truly me.
There's a giant eraser moving across the USA, and the letters T and Q are disappearing from the government's LGBTQ-related websites and publications. The Trump administration has even wiped any mention of transgender people from the signage outside the Stonewall National Monument, despite the fact that it was trans activists who launched the 1969 rebellion it memorializes. While conservative politicians are using their network of far-right media outlets to power the transphobic purge, This Way Out's David Hunt met one New York college student who's focused on a new kind of narrative, the history and the joy of transmasculine community building.
In an open letter to the academic community in the summer of 2009, scholar Eve Tuck urged educators to reconsider the impact of what she called damage-centered research, work that focuses on people's pain and brokenness to hold those in power accountable for their oppression. It may be well-intentioned, she wrote, but this type of research reinforces and reinscribes a one-dimensional notion of people as depleted, ruined, and hopeless. Instead, she said, academics should seek to understand the complexity, contradiction, and self-determination of the people they study. Focus on their desires, not their damage, she said. As Tuck wrote those words, seated at a little table in her Hudson Valley, New York home, a young tomboy in rural Pennsylvania looked up at the night sky, caught a glimpse of a shooting star, and made a wish. I hope I wake up
tomorrow and I'm a boy.
Today.
just a dance of light and darkness, of life and death.
I'm David Hunt. Eli Butler's wish did come true, eventually. The Pennsylvania tomboy is now a 22-year-old transgender man, living in New York City, and conducting academic research of his own. Research centered on the joy of being transmasculine. Research influenced by the scholarship of Eve Tuck, and inspired by the transmasculine activists who paved his way. I no longer want damage to be the focus of research about trans communities, Butler said in his senior thesis for a degree in peace and justice studies. I want to shift the research narrative toward possibility. I sat down with Butler to discuss his life, his research, and the possibilities of the future.
I love being trans. Like, I've enjoyed this journey. I think that life is like, and for everybody, is just kind of learning more about yourself every day and like making changes in your life that accompany that. So I'm like still figuring out who I am as a trans person every day.
That's not to say the Pace University undergraduate's life is free from oppression. On the day we talked, the National Park Service was busy rewriting history, erasing the story of the transgender activists who led the 1969 protests at the Stonewall Inn, what is now the Stonewall National Monument, less than 2 miles from the Pace University campus in New York. But the Trump administration's efforts to legally extinguish the visibility, even the very existence, of transgender people has galvanized the community. More than 1,000 protesters rallied at the historic site on February 14th to decry the Park Service's erasure of trans history. It seemed fitting that this demonstration of loud and proud queer community should happen while Butler and I discussed the focus of his senior thesis, community building by transmasculine people, past and present. In researching his thesis at the New York Public Library and in archives of transgender publications and organizations, Butler discovered that transmasculine community building has a rich and layered history going back generations.
I think that, like, a lot of times we think that trans people were all underground until the 2000s or until the late 90s. But that was not the case. And reading these newsletters was like, wow, they've been telling us that we haven't existed until now. Like, we have existed and been loud about it for decades now.
The literature review section of Butler's thesis is a history lesson, chronicling the contributions of trans men who are largely unknown and unappreciated today, including Steve Dane, who made headlines in the late 1970s after transitioning and being fired from his job as a public high school teacher, and Mario Martino, who established a counseling service for trans men called Labyrinth in 1968.
It was really heartwarming to me to see the ways that different trans guys talked about themselves and talked about the other trans guys that they were with, how similar it was to experiences that I've had and other people had. I just think there's so many similarities, even though we're living in such different political climates and like just different cultural times. I think there's so many things that we can look back on and take inspiration from on how to organize now and how to like find our community and surround ourselves with our supportive community now.
To learn more about community building by trans masculine men today, Butler interviewed 3 trans men, a licensed therapist in a southern state who facilitates a virtual trans masculine support group, the leader of the Louisville Trans Masculine Alliance in Kentucky, and a counselor for the Virginia Tech chapter of Delta Lambda Phi, a fraternity for gay, bisexual, transgender, and progressive men. Among Butler's findings, masculinity can be problematic.
I see a lot of stuff online from people who are like, you're going to the dark side, like when you're transitioning into a masculine identity. And so I think a lot of masculine people like feel discouraged by that, and they want to be around people who also see masculinity more in a more positive light.
Butler found that community building evolved as a survival tactic to create spaces of support and understanding among an astoundingly underrepresented and isolated group. And he demonstrated that community building is affected by differences in geography and organizing styles.
I mean, there are similarities between all of the groups for sure, but you know, based on the different focuses of these groups, you're having different community building experiences. So like one of these was this like trans masculine frat. And so, you know, building community in a frat is so much different than building community in a support group. Like you're talking about different things, you're focusing on different things, but there is like this general relation between everybody. Even these groups that are so different in how they go about building community, they are talking about and focusing on similar things. They're just going about it in different ways.
A nearly universal advantage of community building, Butler found, is its role in healing trauma. Trauma isolates. The group recreates a sense of belonging, Butler explained, referencing the work of American psychiatrist Judith Lewis Herman.
I read a lot of books from therapists and psychiatrists about how building community heals trauma, which I think is especially important in the trans community, which even if you're a trans person that hasn't experienced any kind of personal transphobia, you know, you're living in this society which is just violently transphobic. So building community like allows you to heal those wounds in a certain way. You're now in a place where people understand you. They understand your trauma. Maybe they've been through similar things, or in the broader way, they understand exactly the feelings that you're feeling. And you can process that trauma together. And that is the healing power of community.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my conversation with Eli Butler about his research into transmasculine community building. Butler's academic work is informed by his personal journey as a transgender man. That journey began at an early age.
I actually realized I was trans when I was in the fourth grade. I think I was around 8 years old. I changed my name. I went through like kind of a social transition, which is kind of the most that a lot of younger kids can do. I wore, you know, more masculine clothing. I went by a different name. I went by different pronouns. That was so against the status quo. Not that like being trans isn't against the status quo already, but you know, for someone so young. And so I was kind of like, I want to say forced out of that, or like kind of pressure was put on me to grow out of that. And so I went back to living as a woman and identifying as a woman until around COVID. And COVID was really the time when I had time to sit with myself. And I feel like this happened to a lot of people. It was like the first time you were forced to be alone with your thoughts and really like reflect on how you see yourself, how you see the world. And that's when I realized that I was non-binary. And then when I finally came to college, I realized that I was more binary masculine than I thought I was at first.
But even in New York, a metropolis with one of the world's largest LGBTQ populations, Butler discovered that something was missing in his life.
I mean, I think of New York in terms of like the gay revolution of the 70s, expecting it to be like full of activities and clubs and groups of people that just like were so like out and proud about their queerness or their transness. And I came to New York and to a liberal arts college thinking that's how it would be. I would find my people who understood me and it would just be so easy. And it was not. And I actually found a lack of transmasculine specifically groups in New York City.
It was that experience, the longing for community, that led Butler to focus his senior thesis on transmasculine community building. In doing that, he discovered the challenges, as well as the joys, of creating change.
One of my interviewees said something that really struck me, and this is how I think of how strengthening community needs to be now. which is that community is a two-way street. You're not just coming to the community or trying to find a community when you need help. You're there all the time. You're there to support people when they need help. And then so that when you need help, you can and you can come to them.
Now that his senior thesis is done, Butler has the time to focus on some community building of his own. He's spearheading a project to create a quilt of trans joy, a project inspired by the Norfolk Trans Joy Community Quilt, a project led by partners Beau Brannick and Alice Bigsby Bye in the United Kingdom.
I am holding workshops where trans people, trans students can come in and, you know, their allies, their loved ones, or their friends can come in, make a quilt square. Then it's going to be this big quilt of like trans joy. And it's going to be put up in the LGBTQ center at the school and whatnot. So it's like, it's half this like community building and art focused kind of project. And it's also half like a political resistance kind of message.
At the end of the day, Butler explained, building community is about finding your people and finding your joy.
I can't imagine being a young trans person right now, looking at the news and being like, wow, like my identity is all based in suffering, because that's a lot of times what it seems like. I've had younger trans people like in my life say this to me, where they're like, you seem like you like being trans, like, can you tell me that it gets better? I like want to be living proof to younger trans people that like you can be trans and love being trans and be proud of it and have joy in your life and find community that also like centers that joy.
I'd like to thank Eli Butler for sharing his story for this program. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Ava Davis and Joe Bainline and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's feature. Seals and Croft, T. Ricky, J. Patrick Lemieux, and Michael Shines performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Hal Myers of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on KRZA, Alamosa, Colorado, WCRX, Chicago, Illinois, CJLY, Nelson Crawford Bay, New Denver, British Columbia, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.